observation. It's a primary driving force of science. Once a phenomenon has been observed, a hypothesis can be proposed, experiments can be constructed and carried out, data can be collected, models can be developed, and theories can be established. Observation has an integral part in the development of science. Today I'd like to talk with you about the last 150 years or so in science, the major developments as they relate to a belief in a creator. And we're going to focus on how new observations have sometimes brought marvelous truth to light, how the scientific process, when carefully followed and reasonably followed, can bring truth and understanding that's really amazing and awesome. While at other times, observations are ignored or distorted to fit a viewpoint that the world tries to sell us against the God of the Bible. So after we have weighed some of the evidence, we'll examine whether scientific findings from the last 100, 150 years confirm and point to the God of the Bible, or whether they point to this random, empty, and utterly meaningless existence put forward by secular thinkers today. As we go, I'm also going to give you takeaways. So I'll give this away. I have three takeaways today as we go through the message that will be somewhat unrelated to the story, but just on these principles of how our lives model that scientific method, the way that God has called us to live. And I'll go ahead and give you the first one because it has to do with observation, which is going to be a key thread that runs through. So the first takeaway is that we need to observe. We need to observe. If we've got our Bibles, let's go ahead and turn to Psalm chapter 34 and verse 8. Psalm 34 and verse 8. Because God has given us amazing capacities to learn and to grow and to understand, to notice patterns. Even, you know, I mentioned the babies. Nobody has to tell them to look for faces. They just naturally start to do it. Psalm 34. I'm still trying to turn there. Psalm 34. Nobody has to tell them to do it. But after about a month, they recognize faces and patterns. God designed things this way. Psalm 34, verse 8 says, "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who trusts in him." And then going backwards to verse 4, "I sought the Lord and he heard me and delivered me from all my fears." You can see elements of the scientific method embedded in this, and this idea of observation. God says, "Taste and see that the Lord is good." So it should be a rather obvious point that God has imbued us with the senses to give us the power to observe, to reason abstractly, to notice patterns, and to build knowledge. And he calls on us to use that. And we'll talk about that throughout the message. I'm going to use this word observe and observation a lot, so I'd like to give you a definition of it before we get too much further. To observe, it's kind of a long, wordy definition, so don't worry about writing every word down. To observe is to inspect or take note of details with the goal of noticing patterns and extrapolating rules that govern the behavior of a system. To inspect or take note of details with the goal of noticing patterns and extrapolating rules to govern the behavior of a system. It's to look at something and think about it, to notice things about it, and really try to figure out, how does this work? That's what it means to observe in the scientific sense. And part of the story of the last 150 years of science is breaking through the barriers and limitations on our powers of observation. If you've ever thought about it, really the advancement of science depends on advancements in observation and the ability to observe new and different things. For thousands of years, people could only see with the eye. And you look out and we see things at what's called the mesoscale. We see things, you know, maybe about as small as an ant or a little bit smaller. And we can look out and we can see far off mountains in the distance. We can see the stars in the sky, but the level of detail that we can see is not that great compared to, say, a telescope that extends our sight from just seeing little dots, bright dots in the sky, to understanding that there are whole other worlds out there and galaxies, other systems of stars and planets and asteroids and comets and all sorts of amazing things, literal new worlds that this observational tool, the telescope, opens up. And if we think about the small scale, the microscope opens up figurative new worlds. Right? You can see that if I look down at my hand, well, really, it's made up of cells. And those cells are made up of little organelles, as they call them. And those things are made of molecules. And those things are made of smaller and smaller things. We can see all the way down to the atomic scale, the electron scanning microscopes, and these kinds of things. And it extends even beyond sight. Right, we have tools that can monitor vibrations, that can pick up seismic activity in the earth, things that can detect electromagnetic waves or heat signatures that aren't readily available to our senses. The development of these new tools and technologies is what allows science to move forward. Suddenly we can receive a new signal that we had never noticed, and we can sit, look at it, and think about it, and learn something from it. So we're going to talk about that going back to about 100 years ago, the year 1917. It's a landmark year for science. At that time, the theory of the universe was that it was static. They called it the static universe. Right? Today, every school child is taught something very different than that. We all know that the universe isn't static and stationary in place, but that it's expanding, right? Little kids know that. It's part of our culture. Everyone knows it. And the reason we know it is because of the work that started in 1917. That's when history's most famous patent clerk, Albert Einstein, put forward his theory of general relativity. Now, I want to explain a little bit more about the static universe before I go into the significance of Einstein's work and getting us to this idea that the universe is expanding. So the static universe was a very appealing idea to secular philosophers. Now, for one thing, in light of observation, up until someone said, hey, the universe might be expanding, no one had a reason to check whether that was true or not. Because when you look, even with powerful telescopes out at the sky and at the stars, they don't really appear to be moving, right? Their movements are so slight because they're so far away. I mean, sure, the stars move in the sky at night. It's really because the planet's moving, and there are a few variations throughout the year. But year by year, the stars return to the same positions, right? Because the Earth is returning to the same spot in its orbit as far as what can readily and easily be seen, even with a telescope. So no one had any reason to think that all the stars and planets were moving away from each other. They just thought they're in place. They're fixed in their courses. In addition to that, secular thinking had come to the conclusion that the universe not only wasn't moving, but that it had always been where it is. That space had always been generally where it is. Space just existed. It was infinite in every direction. Always had been. It was without beginning. And now we start to see a conflict between the static universe and the belief in a creator God, don't we? Because they said that, well, this universe has existed eternally. It doesn't require a creator. If it just exists and had no beginning, things with beginnings certainly require some kind of start to them. But if the universe had no start, if matter and energy and space just existed forever, well, that doesn't require a creator God. We'll talk about that a little bit later in more detail. But this was the prevailing scientific thought of the day. And so Albert Einstein, as bright as he was, came up with his equations of general relativity and his model of the universe. And it told him something different than what the conventional thought was. It told him, first of all, that one of the key realizations he made is that space and time are kind of interwoven like a fabric, and that fabric can bend. It can stretch and compress. Now, on top of that, so that was one of his fundamental ideas, that, you know, gravity, it's like stretching this rubber sheet, if you've seen the illustrations. But on top of that, his model of the universe showed that the space itself was expanding. And that didn't fit the static universe that he understood in his day. So he did something they probably shouldn't have done. He admitted it was his biggest blunder. He added a good old-fashioned fudge factor to his equations. A fudge factor that became known as the cosmological constant, which sounds a lot better and nicer than fudge factor. But what he did was he balanced out the equation. He said, no, this isn't right. The universe shouldn't be expanding. That doesn't fit what we all know to be true, that the universe is static. So I'll just balance out the equation by putting this term here. And look, now it's static again. I put it in perfect equilibrium. Great. Problem solved. Except that scientists are kind of a smart bunch. And somebody sees that and they'll challenge it. That's the whole point of the peer review process that we have. So people started to think, if the universe was expanded, how could I tell? And this opened up whole new lines of research, whole new ways of thinking, whole new questions to ask. How could I detect it? How could I observe a phenomenon like that? It took another 13 years before Edwin Hubble, the guy who the Hubble Space Telescope is named after, observed what's called the red shift in distant galaxies. Basically, it's like the Doppler effect. If you've ever heard a car go by on the road, it doesn't sound the same. The car is making the same noise the whole time, but how's it sound? The pitch changes. Well, the same thing happens with light the further a star is away. It shifts into the red spectrum. Right, so you look out at the stars and you notice the farther away the star is, the more red the light looks. So it was a Doppler effect. And that meant that these stars, the further away they were, the faster they were accelerating away from you. That was the first observed evidence in history that the universe was expanding. It was very exciting. This led to more questions. Okay, well, if it was expanding, has it always been expanding? I mean, if it's going out, it had to be in at some point. And you probably know just enough from, like I said, every school child has taught this, that they eventually conceived of this idea of the Big Bang, that at one point in the distant past, all matter and energy were collected into this hot, dense ball that just suddenly exploded, right, and spread out and stretched out. In 1964 is when they discovered the afterglow of the Big Bang, called the cosmic microwave background radiation. It was one of those things that the theories had predicted, right? They had 34 years of working on this idea. Well, what would the beginning of the universe look like if it had a beginning? And then they found the evidence to confirm it. Very exciting time for physics and astronomy, cosmology, and however else they want to label their field. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. It's a pretty amazing thing for science and a very exciting time. But I think for a lot of people who had been at odds with science for the longest time, it represented a shift in thinking that was pivotal to confirming the God of the Bible. Scientifically, finally science caught up to Genesis 1:1. It took them thousands of years to get to Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The universe that we know and live in had a beginning. And that had been proven for the first time by evidence. It's pretty amazing. Now, that sparked all these questions of, how and the how they came up with the Big Bang, and also the when. And the when is kind of an interesting thing in terms of the Christian landscape today. Now, scientists have dated the universe based on the light from distant stars that's reached us to be around 14 billion years old. I'd like to review just briefly what we in the Church of God believe about the age of the universe, because there are all sorts of ideas out there. And what's really interesting to me is that you have two camps in most of what's called Christianity today. You have the young earth creationists who will look at the biblical record and count back the ages and say, 6,000 years, that's when God created everything, that's when the universe started. Young earth creationists say the entire universe is about 6,000 years old. And that's when God had the 7 days of creation, and that's the way it was. Then you've got old earth creationists who have done a lot of really good scientific work, and they'll say, well, yeah, the universe was created by God, but it was millions of years ago. And their reasoning is very different than ours. We also, in the Church of God, are old earth creationists, if we need to label ourselves in that way. But they look at these 7 days of creation, and they don't see those as literal days. In fact, I was first exposed to that teaching. I went to a Christian school when I was growing up. In ninth grade, I had a Bible class at my Christian school. And they said, oh, well, you see, a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years. So really, these could be long stretches of time, not literal days. But we see a problem with that. First of all, they're presented as literal days of creation. And second of all, the Sabbath is one of those literal days. And it's confirmed pretty well throughout the Bible that it's talking about a 7 day week and the first Sabbath, evening and the morning were the next day. So how do we in the Church of God reconcile these things, an ancient universe with these 7 literal days of creation? I won't go through the entirety of that teaching. You can find it in our booklet, Creation versus Evolution, which is actually really detailed and a really good resource. I was reviewing it, and I thought I'd find a much simpler explanation than what I found, but there's a lot of really deep and detailed material in there. But the gist of the argument comes from the very next verse, Genesis 1 and verse 2. It says that the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Now, this is translated, the earth was without form and void. That the Hebrew word translated as was can also mean became, right? And the meanings are kind of interrelated. They're both state of being verbs. So another example is where Eve was the mother of all the living. Well, Eve had children, and so she became the mother of all the living. In English, we can kind of say it either way, and so there's some ambiguity there. But really, this is better understood throughout the rest of the Bible, verse 2 here, to say that the earth became without form and void. Because we read elsewhere that God didn't create it that way. The key reference there, I won't turn to it, is Isaiah chapter 45 and verse 18, if you'd like that for your notes. Isaiah 45 and verse 18 is where it says God did not create the earth in vain. And that word for in vain is exactly this word for without form. Tohu and bohu, if you've heard it over the years. It's a teaching that you know, we do go through occasionally. Like I said, if you want all the detail, the Creation or Evolution booklet actually has, I think, a good 3 or 4 sub-articles related to this topic that are just really excellent and detailed. But essentially, that's the key to this. God created the heavens and the earth. And then an indefinite period of time passed until something happened to cause it to become without form and void. Now, we understand that to be the angelic rebellion. Like when Christ said, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. And for those who want to take the Bible as a whole, if they want to put it in any other light, they really have some explaining to do for Christ to have said, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven, and for that to have happened in only 6,000 years if they want a young earth viewpoint. And it becomes difficult to explain. But given the understanding that we have about this point, everything falls into line. It falls into line very easily, very easily. And it reconciles with scientific observation, which is a powerful thing, I think. I think that's something that's been important to me. I don't know how many of you know or remember if I have said it. My background's in applied mathematics. I have a PhD in math. So, science and analytical thinking, these are things that are close to me and close to my educational path. And it's great to see that the Bible does say something that represents the reality that's being found and mapped out by science. When it's good science. When it's good science. So let's shift back and look at some of that history again and talk about some of the bad science that's been done. And also some good in it. So key point there to wrap up this idea of the discovery of the Big Bang and the expanding universe before that pivotal shift in understanding. Humans didn't notice that the universe was expanding. They didn't lack the tools to make that they lacked the tools to make that observation. But once somebody had the thought and they started looking, they were able to confirm that that is in fact the case. Up until that point, they were so comfortable with their idea of a static universe, one that didn't require a creator, didn't have a beginning, that they didn't even look for it, even though it was there all along. Now, this whole story has to do with constraints on our ability to observe. So we're going to go back in time another 50 years before Einstein, and we're going to talk about a man named Charles Darwin, who made some observations around that time. In fact, in 1859 is when Darwin published On the Origin of Species, his famous work he published his theories of natural selection, this theory of common ancestry among organisms. Now, what I thought was really interesting in going back and doing the research for this, and this was something maybe I'd been told at one point, so I knew that Darwin had taken a trip to the Galapagos Islands, right? When I was doing this, I actually learned where the Galapagos Islands were. Never really thought about where they were when people would talk about them. They're on either side of Ecuador. Either side of Ecuador. Some in the Pacific, some in the Gulf, just to get us geographically in the right place. So he went around, he just looked at stuff. He did a lot of observing. He looked at the animals and the plants, and he got really focused on the finches, right, a type of bird. And so he drew sketches of all these finches that he saw, and he noticed there were differences between them. And later, as he was comparing his sketches and compiling his thoughts, he noticed that the finches on each island had different characteristics that made them more suitable to that environment. Maybe, you know, on this island they had to crack these hard nuts and so they had bigger, stronger beaks. Or on this island it helped them to blend in with the plant life if they had this pattern on their feathers. But at each island they had kind of developed these unique factors that allowed them to adapt to that specific sub-environment. All the islands being isolated from each other allowed that to happen over time. So the really cool thought that he had was that all of those finches came from some first flock of finches that would have showed up on the island. And all the diversity they saw came from those first finches that showed up there. And that these advantageous traits that each one had for its unique sub-environment, each island, had developed over time. And they eventually distinguished themselves among the finch populations. That's a really cool thought, He didn't stop there, though. He took this idea to another level, one of common ancestry. So the idea for common ancestry among the finches really made sense, right? It was that all the finches came from finches before them, but they're more diverse now than they were. Fine, I'm happy with that explanation. He took that to another level to say, well, maybe those first finches also came from something that didn't even look like a finch. You know, maybe all of the creatures, maybe the lizards came from a common ancestor that didn't really look like lizards. And maybe at some point, the lizards and the finches were one creature that had diversified. And so on, back with all creatures until you get back to some very simple first creature, right? The common ancestor of all life. Now, there was a lot of thought and contemplation that went into that conclusion. But if we talk about what is science, what is observable, all he saw were a bunch of different plants and animals, and he sat there and he looked at some sketches of finches that he made. And he made these conclusions that were way too big for that, way too big. And I think any scientist who's being honest would have to admit that. You know, those who believe in evolution fully and all that stuff would say, oh, well, he was just a visionary. He didn't have the evidence, but he saw it as it is. Either way, you have to wait till those things are proven out. That's just way too big. But we'll talk about some more of that as we go. You know, privately, this wasn't in his published work, but in a private letter, he expressed an even more radical viewpoint for that day and time. Remember, this is the late 1850s. He wrote a private letter to another scientist, Joseph Hooker, and he said, and I'll quote this, he says, if, and oh what a big if, we could conceive in some warm little pond with all sorts of ammonia and phosphoric salts, light, heat, electricity, etc. present, that a protein compound was chemically formed, ready to undergo still more complex changes. If you've ever heard this phrase, warm little pond, or primordial soup, that comes from Darwin's mention in this private letter right? These thoughts that he had had that, you know, maybe life just sprang up at random somewhere. Maybe just all the right elements came together and it just happened that way. Just happened that way, physically, apart from a creator God. Now, it seems that Darwin might not have even believed this himself, something he could conceive of. It, you know, that quote started out with if, and oh, what a big if! Oh, what a big if. So maybe he was skeptical of the idea himself, but it was a seed that took root in the minds of secular thinkers, philosophers, scientists, who built on it, who took it and ran with it, and saw it as the way things must be, because there can't possibly be a God. Such is their bias against a creator. This idea, the name for it, is the idea that life can arise from non-living things. It's called abiogenesis. It comes from taking biogenesis, which means beginning of life, and negating it. Abiogenesis. It's the idea that life can arise naturally from non-living things. Let's talk about evolution, though. We'll come back around to abiogenesis a little bit later in the story. And let's look at what the Bible says. We're still in Genesis. Well, my Bible closed on me, so I'm going to have to open it back up to Genesis 1. In verse 11. Then God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth." And it was so. Talks about the tree is reproducing how? According to its kind. According to its kind. And if we read down, it goes through the birds. And the birds reproduce how? According to their kind. The sea creatures, according to their kinds. The creeping things go according to their kinds. All the creatures that God created on the earth reproduce according to their kinds. That's the biblical view, and that's the one that's actually supported by the evidence that Darwin gathered. We talk about the actual observations that he made, those finches, and that cool idea that he had that those finches came from finches before them and the population diversified, natural selection. That's absolutely supported by the Bible. The creatures can reproduce according to their kinds, and that changes do take place over time. Yeah. But you know, all those finches Darwin saw, not a single one of them ever became something that wasn't a bird. And none of them came from something in the distant past that wasn't a bird. That's the biblical view. That's the biblical view. The creatures reproduce according to their kind. And this is sometimes known as microevolution. If you've heard these terms, microevolution and macroevolution. So microevolution are small changes over time within a species, right? Within a population of a species. Whereas macroevolution is this more fanciful idea that, you know, eventually some blob of bacteria or whatever becomes an elephant or something over billions of years, as it may be. But microevolution stays within the confines of what the Bible teaches. Macroevolution, what exactly is that idea based on? Right, going back to Darwin's idea, and even going back to, you know, think of the imagery, because Darwin started out with these images of finches and noticing differences in these pictures. And the idea of macroevolution is normally sold visually. Right? If you think of the evolution of man, you have a picture in your head that has been burned in by society of an ape, and then one that has a little less hair and stands up a little more upright, and then another one that stands a little more upright, a little less hair, until you get to, you know, something that looks like a Neanderthal, and then something that looks like a primitive man walking upright with no hair. It's a story that looks believable. It's a story that looks believable. But this is a crude level of comparison. Right? It's at this human visual level, this mesoscale. We've come 150 years into the future from that point, and we've learned a lot of things that Darwin knew nothing about. A lot of things he knew nothing about. And yet, the prevailing secular scientific worldview, in light of some of the evidence brought by genetics and by biochemistry, has been completely ignored and swept under the rug. We'll talk some about that. The prevailing view points and clings to these unsupported assertions that Darwin made. The assertions, namely, of macroevolution, that all creatures came from this common ancestor, and that life began by chance in a warm little pond. So it's time for me to give you the second takeaway of the message. The second takeaway, the first one was to observe. The second one is to reflect. To reflect. And specifically, I want to talk about reflecting on avoiding the bias of the carnal mind and secular ways of thinking, because it pervades our society and it attacks us. It attacks us. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. It attacks us through people arguing with us and literally kind of attacking us for the things we believe. That's 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 13 through 14. Sometimes it's a direct attack through people. Sometimes it's doubt within our own selves, because we see and hear the things that are taught by the world, and sometimes they make sense if we don't reflect and think about them. You know, a picture that, you know, clearly shows the ape standing up and losing its hair seems compelling. It tells a story that makes sense. 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 13, at least on the surface it makes sense. Chapter 2 and verse 13. These things we also speak, not in words which man's wisdom teaches, but which the Holy Spirit teaches, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. But the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, nor can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned. The whole way of thinking put forward by this world is corrupt at its core, because it rejects God at its core. And we have to reflect and think about whether we let some of those biases into our mind as we learn, because a good deal of our learning is coming from the world. And you know, the world has built a lot of good and right knowledge at a human level, and it's built a lot of awful, wrong knowledge as well that completely flies in the face of our Creator God. And so it is that as these new fields of study came into being, genetics and biochemistry, they brought, you know, whole new worlds into being of understanding. But those observations were interpreted through a bias against God from the beginning. They weren't weighed evenly and fairly. They were distorted. And so you find this discord, if we look at actual scientific observation, discord between that and the atheistic agenda that we're fed, you know, even from the time that we're little kids. And especially when we look at this in conjunction with the cosmological side of things, and the understanding that came into being that the universe has only been around for 14 billion years or so, we'll see that it doesn't all add up. Their view does not all add up. So what are those things that we know that Darwin didn't know? One of those things that, again, we're taught as little kids is that we all have DNA. Darwin saw these finches, you know, living and dying and being born and reproducing, and he saw that they passed on traits, had no clue how that worked, just that it happened. Whereas, you know, we know, probably from watching Jurassic Park when we were, you know, I saw Jurassic Park when I was a kid. It came out when I was, 10 or 12 years old, perfect age for dinosaurs. And you learn about the double helix. It's like this ladder that's twisted with all these rungs in it. That's DNA that carries the information that's passed on from parent to child, generation to generation, in all organisms, every known organism. Those rungs in the ladder. So I'll give us just a quick review of what that picture, the double helix, the ladder with the rungs, represents. Each of those rungs in the ladder is called a base pair. It's the most fundamental building block of DNA, a base pair. If you get a whole collection of those base pairs, you know, enough rungs of the ladder that are sectioned out, that makes a gene. A gene might have dozens or hundreds or even thousands of base pairs in it. Right, so these ladders get exceedingly long. In fact, the human genome has 3 billion base pairs in it. And those are divided into something like 19,000 genes. And each gene encodes a single protein that makes your body function altogether, that causes it to assemble itself from the nutrients that were given, and, you know, make my hands exactly as long as they are, and all these various amazing, wonderful things that happen. And, you know, it's a process where, you know, you're talking about billions of these base pairs having to be replicated. There's room for error. It's an extremely low level of error. In fact, only about one in 10 billion copyings of these base pairs goes wrong in human beings. One in 10 billion. It's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Now, when one of these base pairs goes wrong, because there's so many of them, a lot of times it doesn't make a very big difference. But this idea that came to light through genetics, it's known as random mutation. It's known as random mutation. And people who wanted an explanation for the diversity of life apart from God took that idea and ran with it. It became the celebrated engine of evolution, that you start with some simple organism and it just reproduces so many times, and these things get copied and there are errors, and that introduces variability, and that causes life to spread, and that bacteria, the first one, becomes a frog and an elephant and a tiger and whatever else. And so this choice of, you know, their what was going to be the engine driving evolution was done completely without regard to reality. And we'll talk about the reality a little bit. But again, it's this sort of thing, just like those pictures of evolution, builds an idea that's believable on the surface. Believable on the surface. Now, in order to be true, evolution has to be true not at the visual level, the ape morphing into a man. Anybody ever read the Animorphs books or remember seeing them? I read a series of books called Animorphs when I was a kid. And every cover, so the gimmick was that the kids in the book could morph into animals right after they had touched them and absorbed their DNA. They could morph into animals. Incredible series for me as a kid. I don't know how they stand up to the test of time as an adult, but you would have an image of this, you know, teenage girl turning into a tiger on the cover, because that was, you know, the central thing of that particular book. She had to turn into a tiger. And so you get this, you know, an artist has illustrated this series of images. Now, if we take just that kind of visual comparison, you can make it look like it makes some kind of sense that a girl could turn into a tiger visually. You know, they did it on the books, every cover. But it doesn't mean anything. What would it take to mean something? If we know that life works at this genetic level with these base pairs, and that's where the mutations occur, then evolution has to actually work at the biochemical level. It has to work within the development of how cells get new capabilities. Right? It would have to explain not something like how an ape loses hair, which seems like a very simple thing to do, but how do you go from literally having nothing that does this to something that can swim in its environment? Motility. Motility is one of the classic examples. How do cells get these selective membranes? How do they know what nutrients to let in, what things are toxic that they should keep out? How do they know, you know, to make these complicated transport systems that go throughout the body of an organism? You know, so that your kidneys can send the signals that you need to every other part of your body. They don't go anywhere that they're not supposed to go or affect things that they're not supposed to. How about blood clotting? There are a lot of amazing, complicated systems that have an awful lot of moving parts. In fact, what we find is that as complex as life might look at the visual level, the deeper down you look, the more and more complicated it gets. The more and more complicated it gets. You take a drop of what looks like regular water out of a pond. Looks clean. You look in it, and there are dozens of little single-celled organisms just darting all around in it, moving. If you look at each one of those, each one of them has its own genome. And that genome has, you know, on the order of millions of base pairs, even for very simple things. You know, the simplest bacterial genome has 500,000 base pairs. The simplest one that's ever been found. 500,000 base pairs. I think it's 300 and something genes altogether, but 500,000 base pairs. And scientists have tried to take that bacteria and whittle away what's needed and try to get a minimal organism, and they still end up with something around that magnitude, 500,000 base pairs, in order for this thing to be self-replicated and sustain life. You might be familiar with a book known as Darwin's Black Box, written by Michael Behe. It was one of the research materials I had for the sermon, and I think he was one of the first to coin this phrase of irreducible complexity. irreducible complexity, which has, I think, become another, or it's more and more becoming a part of the regular vocabulary, again, that we're taught as school children. But an irreducibly complex system is one that's made of multiple components that would fail if any one of the components wasn't present. Okay, so I mentioned this idea of motility, the ability of a cell to swim through its environment. The simplest flagellum system known in bacteria has at least 23 different genes to it. And each one of those has dozens and dozens, some hundreds of base pairs. All that would have to come together just right. And if you didn't have all the pieces together at once, the thing wouldn't swim. It produced a little thing that just kind of hung there and floated and didn't really give the cell any advantage. There'd be no reason for that gene to be passed on. I came up with an example because there are a lot of irreducibly complex systems that we already know and understand that maybe we haven't thought about. We all drove here in one, probably. A car. All right, so think about a car. Could a car have developed by this gradual process of evolution with random changes? The key is, you know, we all know and understand cars to be irreducibly complex systems, right? If my wheels don't turn, I'm not going anywhere. A car that can't go anywhere wouldn't pass on its genetic car material in this kind of fantasy that I'm constructing, right? Or, you know, if there was a big hole in the engine, everything else was perfectly formed, but the engine just had a hole in it that hadn't closed up yet, well, that car is not going to live to reproduce in this idea. It's kind of comical. But with living organisms, close doesn't count. Close doesn't count. If something's not functional, it doesn't survive to be passed on. If it's not functional, it doesn't survive. So if we take a creature that has one of these, you know, irreducibly complex systems, say it was perfectly formed and had all but one part missing. Let's say not even missing. Just a part that isn't quite up to snuff. So let's say we have a car and it's perfectly formed except that it's got square wheels instead of round. It's already got wheels, they're made out of the right materials, they're rubber and everything, except they're square and they don't turn. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It's not going to go anywhere and it's not going to reproduce. The same has to be true for cells. If they have something that would be a great advantage if, you know, this one part were just up to snuff, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It doesn't get them anywhere. It doesn't get passed on. These types of systems have to be developed all at once. That's why cars break down in so many different ways. And what a time we have with that. Now, if random mutation is the way that everything got to be the way that it is, if that were really true, then this really raises the bar, because you're not talking about incremental changes, you know, one thing happening at a time randomly. You'd have to have a whole bunch of these base pairs change at once within a single organism. Enough to give it that advantage and for that to be passed on. It becomes incredibly unlikely. So I tried to think of a way to compare this to a lottery. So imagine you have a lottery ticket. Just for curiosity and for the sake of bringing it up in this message, I looked up the odds of winning Powerball, something I'd never thought of before. Odds of winning Powerball are about 1 in 300 million. You have to match six numbers to get that, right? Have to match all six numbers. It's pretty unlikely. None of us are ever going to win the lottery. Probably we don't even try. It's throwing away money. Imagine you had a lottery ticket with not six numbers to match, but say, you know, if we're talking about a single gene in the human genome, thousand, couple thousand, maybe more numbers you have to match on this lottery ticket. And not only that, random mutation, what did I say it was? About 1 in 10 billion is the rate. So you got a 1 in 10 billion chance, not of winning the lottery, but of getting a single number on that ticket correct. I could do all the math for you, but the numbers involved, I mean, they're hard to even understand how unlikely that is. You know, it's kind of an interesting fact, actually. All right, so if you got a mutation rate of about 1 in 10 billion, and our genome has about 3 billion base pairs, I'll walk you through it, because I think it's kind of fun. So hang on with me. All right, so if you got 3 billion base pairs and 1 in 10 billion is a mutation, then every person gets one base pair mutation, right? So what are the odds? So if I have this gene out there that would be advantageous, if only I could mutate to it, my odds of getting one of those numbers on that lottery ticket are 1 in 10 billion. But there's 7 billion people on the earth, right? So we would expect maybe a couple of people will get a single number on that lottery ticket. But there's still something like 1,000 more ticks on that lottery ticket you got to check off. So now the only people who get to play in the second round are the offspring of those people. And it very quickly adds up. Basically, you would never have enough time. You would have to have trillions and trillions of years in order to even start to get close to building even just one gene, to encode a single protein that does something in the human body by random mutation. Takeaway, if you didn't follow that, even the simplest known systems are incredibly complicated. Incredibly complicated. There's so much that God put into the design of them, and it's obvious that He did design them. They involve sometimes dozens or hundreds of chemical reactions. They have intermediate states in those reactions that serve no purpose other than to get you to that end stage. You know, scientists have spent some time trying to speculate on how these, you know, gradual processes might have produced a single, simple, irreducibly complex system. And, you know, in some cases, they've written out a story, right, for how the flagellum might have first formed in a bacteria, right, taking the simplest case that they can get their hands on. But it's just that. It's speculation. It's not observation. They've never seen it happen. Nobody's ever seen a single, irreducibly complex system in the biological world come into being on its own. Never. And that constraining factor is time. So the universe, we said, scientists now believe to be about 14 billion years old. The Earth, only 4.5 billion years old from the geological record, as best they can figure. Now, an interesting fact, so that sounds like, well, you've got 4.5 billion years for life to get going and do whatever it's going to do. Not nearly enough time to begin with. But what we haven't really even touched yet is this tricky problem of how life got started, right? Darwin's idea of abiogenesis, how life could have developed from unorganized, lifeless chemicals. You know, not only has there not been time for even a single one of these irreducibly complex biological systems to develop in a bacteria, much less bring us all the way to, you know, us being fully functional people who can converse and do all the things that we do that are so amazing. But the probabilities of life starting on its own from these chemical processes is, again, astronomically low. I want to go back and set the context of what Darwin said in that private letter. Remember, he said, if, and what a big if, there were this warm little pond, right? Perhaps one of the reasons that Darwin was even skeptical of his own idea here goes back to some research that had been done a couple of decades just before Darwin's Origin of Species by a man named Louis Pasteur. Louis Pasteur struck down an idea called spontaneous generation. So let's get our minds back on observation. Spontaneous generation is the idea that, for example, if you leave a piece of meat out for too long, maggots grow in it, right? Where did the maggots come from? Well, if you've never had a microscope and you can't see the eggs that were laid by a fly, you think they just popped up there. They spontaneously generated. Seems like a silly idea, but again, going back to what can be observed, that's all you see. One day there's no worms, the next day there's worms. Yeah, there are flies buzzing around, but they didn't understand at that point that the worms became flies from eggs. And they didn't understand the whole life cycle there. So it seemed totally reasonable, and it fit their observations and the tools of observation that they had to believe that life just sprung up all the time, everywhere, naturally, without a God, by the way. Without a God. So Louis Pasteur actually did an experiment involving yeast, right? A very simple microorganism that grows on bread and just about everything else. And he was able to prove that if you isolate a specimen and don't allow it to be contaminated by something that already had yeast on it, don't allow it to touch anything, yeast just won't grow. No matter how long you wait, it will not spontaneously generate. And his great conclusion is that life only comes from other life. The biogenetic principle. Now, he was arguing against spontaneous generation, which is really a strong form of abiogenesis. So abiogenesis is Darwin's idea that life can pop up in a warm little pond with just the right non-living stuff. Spontaneous generation is more like, yeah, worms just kind of pop up in meat. It's a stronger form of the same idea. But the principle, the principle is the same. If life can only come from life, then how could life begin from non-living things? That was in Darwin's mind. And nevertheless, he still had his warm little pond idea. You know, the warm little pond has actually been tested scientifically. So I'll tell you about an experiment that was done in 1952. The Miller experiments, or the Miller-Urey experiment. 1952, it's offered as a landmark proof that life arose spontaneously out of nothing. And it's offered and championed as proof. This is one of the greatest distortions in all of science. The biggest distortion I've ever seen in science, and persists to this day. What they did is they took something like Darwin's warm little pond, right? So they got some water, they put some methane, they put some ammonia, some hydrogen, they added some electricity and zapped it good, and what popped out? Well, they'd have you believe that it was life. You would be surprised if you had ever heard this experiment described, that not a single living thing was generated in this experiment. What came into being were amino acids. You might have heard of amino acids. If you know any bodybuilders, they probably take whole scoops of them in powder form. Amino acids are something that are essential for every life form. They're what proteins are made out of. But they're not living things. They don't replicate themselves in any way. They don't carry information that's passed in any way. They just don't. But because these are things essential for life, they said, oh, well, the things essential for life can be made in a warm little pond. Therefore, life actually came into being in a warm little pond in this way. I love that phrase, warm little pond. Forgive me if I say it several times, just to drive the point home. Would you be surprised to know also that this experiment didn't work the first several times they did it, and that they had to sit and adjust the levels of the different components involved, the levels of methane, the levels of ammonia and hydrogen, all those things had to be fine-tuned in order to even get these building blocks of life. Does that sound more like a random process or more like a design process? It just seems like they really had this rush to jump to a very weakly supported conclusion. And that is bad science. It absolutely is. Considering the probabilities involved in the formation of a simple life form, it just doesn't add up. It just doesn't. I'd like to look just real quick at what the Bible says about this, about the biogenetic principle and about life coming from other living things. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7. This one surprised me, to be honest. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7 is how God explains and really confirms the biogenetic principle. When God created man, Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7, the Lord God formed the man of the dust of the ground. Okay, great. But it says more. And breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. So God formed the man, but the man wasn't alive yet. You can just imagine Adam lying there, fully created but lifeless, until God shared the breath of life with Adam. And in fact, if you read the creation account, the other creatures, they also had their life shared from God. He's the one who gives life to all things. And so this biogenetic principle isn't violated or contradicted by the Bible. In fact, it's established right there in the first two chapters of Genesis that life comes from life. Namely, all life on this planet comes from God's life. Comes from God's life. All right, the third takeaway of the message. I think we're ready for it. Is reason. Observe, reflect, and now reason. I won't turn there, but Isaiah chapter 1, verse 18 says, come and let us reason together. come and let us reason together. I will turn to Proverbs chapter 4 if you want to start turning there. God gave us these incredible mental faculties, incredible abilities like we talked about, that allows us to build knowledge and to learn and to analyze and to think. And he wants us to use them. He says, come, let us reason together. That scripture is actually talking about God reasoning together about sin and his ability to forgive. But the principle is still there, and it's expounded here in Proverbs chapter 4 and verse 5, where he talks about wisdom. He says it really emphatically. He says, get wisdom, get understanding. Do not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her, for she will preserve her. Love her, and she will keep you. Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom, and in all you're getting, get understanding. So my third takeaway is reason. To exercise and use the faculties that God has given. And really to do these three takeaways altogether, right? To observe, to taste and see that the Lord is good, to reflect and make sure we clear away the biases that the world wants to imbue, and then to really reason, to get understanding, to analyze and to think, and to fulfill the potential that God has given us in our minds. We still have a ways to go in the sermon. Even though I've got to the last takeaway, I still got a ways to go, so I don't want to get you too excited. So let's talk about the problem of origins. The problem of origins. We talked about the problem of the origin of life, biologically. There's also a problem of the origin of the universe in physics. How did something come from nothing? It plagues physicists. If matter in the universe didn't simply always exist, then when and how did they come into being? In other words, how can something come from nothing, from their perspective, in the absence of any cause or reason or intelligent, supremely magnificent creator God? I have answers from Stephen Hawking. I have a couple of quotes from Stephen Hawking. He actually passed away, I don't know if you're aware of that, back in, I think it was March of this year, maybe April. Stephen Hawking, probably the most famous scientist during my lifetime, wrote the following in his 2010 book, The Grand Design. He said, because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists, why we exist. It's not necessary to invoke God. Those are his exact words. And I can't help but think of how Pasteur struck down this idea of spontaneous generation. And here Hawking is, I don't know if he's knowingly saying spontaneous creation or not, but it sounds so much like spontaneous generation. It's hard to miss the connection there. Now, there's no sense at all in this statement. He's just pushing the goalposts further, right? Because he's hanging everything on gravity. He says, well, gravity's there and everything just comes from gravity. It all makes sense physically. Well, no, but hold on. Where did the gravity come from, Mr. Hawking? And, how is it that gravity was just so perfectly suited to make a universe like this one that supports life? In fact, the further the universe has been investigated, the more evident it becomes that life could not exist in a universe that was even slightly different than the one we live in. It's an incredible and humbling fact. I have another quote from Stephen Hawking from 1988. His most famous work, you might know, is A Brief History of Time, 1988. Tell me if this even sounds like the same guy when he says this. He says, the laws of science, as we know them at present, contain many fundamental numbers. Many fundamental numbers, like the size of the electric charge of the electron and the ratio of the masses of the proton and the electron. The remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. So on the one hand, 1988, he's thinking, there's something to this. These fundamental numbers seem to have been finely adjusted. Well, by who or by what? Well, according to his 2010 self, by gravity. Gravity adjusted them. I don't know whether he was aware of that inconsistency, but I was surprised to find those two quotes in such contradistinction to one another. But let's talk about a couple of those fundamental numbers. He mentioned a couple here that is glossed over that I'm not going to explain. The size of the electric charge of the electron and such. Let's think about some that we can understand pretty easily. Because there have been, some have identified hundreds of these fundamental numbers that have to be just right or things just don't work. We don't get a universe that can sustain life. So let's think about the rate of expansion of the universe, because that's relevant to what we've already talked about, right? Once the universe was found to be expanding, question, how fast is it expanding? And once you know that, well, why and what does it matter? Well, this is what it matters. If the universe expanded much faster than it currently does or has throughout history, matter would be so spread out and so far apart from one another that it wouldn't be able to come together and make stars. Right? It wouldn't have come together and made a sun. And stars are like these planet-forming fusion engines. Okay, so what happens is that these fusion reactions take place and all of these heavier elements are put together and the matter comes together so that you get these things like oxygen and nitrogen and carbon that are essential for life. The building blocks of life at the atomic level come from reactions within stars. So if you have no stars, you don't get that. The rate of the expansion of the universe is even a little faster. You don't get stars, you don't get planets, you don't get life. Well, what if it had expanded a little bit slower? What would have happened? Then the matter would be bunched up too densely, and all the stars, instead of, you know, forming into planets and these other things, collapse into black holes. You'd have black holes everywhere. And you wouldn't be able to have the formation of planets because everything just gets sucked in. None of the stars can be self-sustaining for long enough to build those things, and the universe just collapses back in on itself. So in terms of the rate of the expansion of the universe, it's very delicately balanced. Now, within those fusion engines, there's another fundamental number embedded within stars and the reactions that takes place. It's the strength of the nuclear force. All right, if the strength of the nuclear force was a little different, then those chemical reactions, that fusion reaction in a star that allows a planet to form, couldn't take place. So even if the rate of expansion was right, and you get stars, but you don't get the right strength of the nuclear force, those reactions don't take place and you don't get planets. And nothing's going to come to life on the surface of a star. It's just not going to happen. And there are many, like I said, hundreds even of these physical constants that have to be just right, set within very narrow ranges, in order to have this elaborate, ages-long process of star formation, planet formation, to play out just right to provide a life-sustaining environment like the one we live on, planet Earth. Now, given these kinds of observations that have been made about the universe, what does reason tell us? We're faced with this fundamental truth that it is far more likely, if everything was left to chance, we'd end up with a universe that didn't sustain life than one that did. Physicists have largely come to recognize this. I have a quote from a physicist named Paul Davies, published in the International Journal of Astrobiology. So this is from a publication in a scientific journal. He said, "There is now broad agreement among physicists and cosmologists that the universe is in several respects fine-tuned for life." Everybody agrees on this. So how do they persist in a disbelief in God? How do they get around it? Well, the carnal mind can't accept the things of God. It just can't. And so they look for another way. And that way, you've probably heard about, is getting more and more popular. I hear about it all the time. I feel like everywhere I turn, I'm hearing about a multiverse. You ever heard of the multiverse? Yeah, the multiverse. This idea, I remember first hearing about this when I was in high school. And just like those, you know, pictures that told a story of an ape turning into man, it's a very appealing intellectual idea that everything that can happen does happen. That there's a universe out there where you made the basketball team and went on to become an NBA star. That there's a universe out there where you got in a car crash last week and you're not here anymore. Or there's a universe out there where, you know, everybody has two left feet, or, you know, all kinds of outlandish things. And many, many universes where there's no life at all, and many, many universes where there's life of all different kinds. Infinite universes. It's an enticing idea. It's one that's not grounded on any type of science. What did I kind of base this whole message on as far as science go? Observation. Not only has the multiverse not been observed, as far as anyone can tell, there are no proposals for how it could be observed. It's not a scientific theory at all. It's a philosophical daydream. A philosophical daydream that people use to help them, I don't know, cope with the fact they don't want to believe in a God creating the world and what that means for their lives? Sure seems that way. Whenever the ability to make observation is not present, we are not in the realm of science. And that's where the multiverse stands. In fact, the multiverse, I wrote this in my notes, so I might as well say it. It fails all three of my takeaways. There's no observation involved, right? It's completely based on a bias against God, and it utterly disregards reason. Utterly disregards it. Nonsensical. Now, furthermore, if you decide I'm going to buy into this multiverse idea, it still doesn't even explain the big question. Well, if there's multiverses, why are there multiverses? Why is there anything at all? Why is there something rather than nothing? It still doesn't even touch the something from nothing problem. I have another quote from an astrophysicist, Brian Keating. He said, "The same scientists who reject God's existence due to a lack of evidence pin their hopes on a theory that's so all-inclusive and so vague that it can never be refuted. Those who believe in God, or who believe that God created the universe, are intellectually honest enough to admit that they do so on the basis of faith." I thought that was interesting. You know, this theory that's all-inclusive and vague and can't be refuted, isn't that kind of what they accuse Christians of doing? Believing in something that, you know, isn't observable and that God can't be proven by science, and that's why they reject it? Now, I have to disagree with Mr. Keating in the last thing that he said. You know, he said that Christians are intellectually honest enough to admit that we do this on the basis of faith. I think that, in fact, our human capacity, our God-given capacity for observation, points us squarely to confidence in the belief in the God of the Bible. Let's turn to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 22, where Paul gives us some musings that are really relevant to what we're talking about and give us a little bit of an answer. Romans chapter 1, verse 18 says that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. What does it sound like to you when people aren't willing to believe that there is a God who exists without a creator, when just a century ago they were willing to believe that a universe existed without a creator, or now that a whole host of universes, a multiverse, exists without a creator? Without a beginning, I meant to say. You know, it's fine if the universe didn't have a beginning, but it's not fine if there's a God without a beginning. Is that a double standard? Is that suppressing the truth and unrighteousness when they look at the probabilities involved in evolution and say, oh, well, that's solved by a multiverse, right? Because once you have this infinitude of universes, doesn't matter how long it would have taken, we just happen to be in a lucky universe where everything happened right at the right time, just the way it did. So we're surrounded by these things that are just not true and not good science. Macroevolution, abiogenesis, the multiverse, things that have not been observed, things that fall terribly short of explaining how life came to be within the relatively short age of the universe. Paul summed it up in verse 28 of the same chapter. You know, how do people end up in this persistent disbelief of God? He said, even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. You know, God has allowed people to go down that path because the carnal mind is hostility against God or enmity against God. So what can we conclude? You know, looking at this, you know, what evidence is there for the God of the Bible, just from the creation and just scientifically, from the things we've talked about here in this message today? I have two of these observations. The first one, the thing that has been seen and discovered, are these irreducibly complex systems. Irreducibly complex systems. And the fact that, you know, we have seen irreducibly complex systems come into being, but only at the hands of intelligent beings, humans. Not me necessarily, I've never invented anything, but, you know, people have designed cars, they've designed air conditioning, thankfully, and all these other irreducibly complex systems. You know, if we see that these things can and do come about by intelligent design effort, then how can we look at these things where we've never seen one come together on its own biologically, and that the biological systems are far more complicated than the AC or the space shuttle or, you know, you name it, something humans have designed, the greatest, largest supercomputers? None of it is anywhere near the complexity of even the simplest bacteria, single-celled organism. So the evidence there, what we observe, is that things of this type have to be created. That's the only way we see them come into being. That's our evidence for a creator. Second observation is that against all odds, the universe sustains life. The fine-tuning of the universe and the fact that, again, the probabilities are just stacked so high. If any one of these hundreds of little parameters were any different, we couldn't be here. For that to have happened randomly or by chance, to chalk that up to coincidence is foolish. It's foolish. Let's turn to Proverbs chapter 8. Now, what's not foolish, what's reasonable, actually, if we exercise our faculties, is to realize that where it seems like a lot of things came together in exactly the right way to a level of precision and detail that even as humans, we are nowhere near capable of engineering, to believe that there's a master craftsman out there is reasonable. And that's what we read about in Proverbs chapter 8. Well, I'll look at verse 22 through 31. So this is talking about wisdom figuratively. It says, "The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his way, before his works of old. I've been established from everlasting, from the beginning, before there was ever an earth." Skipping down, verse 26, "While as yet he had not made the earth or the fields or the primal dust of the world, when he prepared the heavens, I was there, when he drew a circle on the face of the deep." Skipping down to verse 30, "Then I was beside him as a master craftsman, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and my delight was with the sons of men." So God didn't just throw out this random thing. There wasn't just some universe that randomly came together with no cause or reason. No, the Bible tells us that there was a master craftsman. You know, before any of these intellectual ideas ever got kicking around in anyone's head about the way things could be, God told us something very reasonable and something that's true if we exercise our faculties, that he was the master creator, the master craftsman who designed these things just so. Just so. Now, as we do start to wrap up, I have a couple of more scriptures, but let's go to Isaiah chapter 42 and kind of bring back Isaiah chapter 42 and verse 5 brings a lot of these concepts together in one place in an order that I just found to be remarkable, really remarkable. Isaiah chapter 45, and again, this is long before telescopes or microscopes or any of it. Before the biogenetic principle was understood, before the expansion of the universe, before any of that. I turned to the wrong chapter. If I said it wrong, it's Isaiah 42 and verse 5. I turned to 45, I was about to look at verse 2. So, Isaiah 42 and verse 5 says, "Thus says the Lord God, who created the heavens and stretched them out." Stretched them out. "Who spread forth the earth and that which comes from it, who gives breath to the people on it, and spirit to those who walk on it." So a couple of things to notice here. I kind of stopped there to hopefully connect the dots for you. He stretched out the heavens. Right? Nobody even come close to thinking about an expanding universe until 100 years ago. And yet here, 3,000 years, well, I didn't do the exact math on that, but the time of Isaiah, let's see, if I remember, he would have been 700s BC, so 2,700 years ago. Isaiah is writing this prophecy from God who's saying, listen, I was the one who did this. I stretched out the heavens. I stretched them out. They were in a little ball, and I stretched them out. That sounds an awful lot like what science has confirmed. And just reading through the scripture, you know, thinking about the order that science has now understood, that you had the creation of the universe and then the earth, right? Universe at 14 billion years ago, but then the earth only 4.5 billion years ago. He goes in that order. Heavens, then the earth, spreading forth the earth, and then giving breath to the people on it. And even there, we see the biogenetic principles, don't we? It's not just creating man. It's not just gathering the dust together in the right component. It's breathing the breath of life into this creature, sharing life, because life can only come from life. Just like Pasteur showed. So now we've kind of come around to a point where we need to answer this final question, right? The big question in biology, the big question in physics, how does life come from, or how does life get started? Life from non-life or something from nothing? How does God answer those questions? Let's turn to Psalm chapter 90 and verse 2. Psalm chapter 90 and verse 2. Unlike the universe, which has a beginning, we're told in Psalm chapter 90 and verse 2 that God does not have a beginning. And that's a very important fact. Psalm chapter 90 and verse 2 says, before the mountains were brought forth, wherever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. God answers the question of beginnings by simply existing. Existing. Exactly the way scientists thought that the universe could have just existed indefinitely into the past. If it had no beginning, it needs no creator. And God is the same way. The Bible tells us that he is without beginning. Do you know how foreign of a concept that is compared to all the other gods that persisted through history? All of them had their origin story, right? They were born out of Zeus's head, right? Cracked it open and out popped a god. And, you know, this or that god was born, and so their story began. God doesn't have that. The true God of the Bible is without beginning. Without beginning. And the novelty of that fact is easily lost on us in modern times. Easily lost on it. But that's how God answers that question of beginnings. And what about life? How life can only come from other living things? He answers it a very similar way. I won't turn there, but John chapter 5 and verse 26 tells us that the Father has life in himself. So in the same way that he has just this greater sense of existence than the physical universe we see, he has this greater form of life. His life essence transcends the physical life that we know, so that he is able to fill that role and be the source of all life that we see. And that's not something that we have to make up. That's something that it says right in our Bibles, that he has life in himself, that he exists from everlasting, has no beginning. And these two critical points are unique among any other deity that's been described in history. So I just want to recap those three takeaways again. Because God has given each of us, in some sense, a lifetime of experimentation. Right? That's what our life is. He tells us to observe, to make an observation, to taste and see, to try his way of life, to test him and see that his way is true, that he is the true God. He tells us to reflect, to not let our observations be limited by secular thinking and the carnal mind that pulls at us. He tells us to reason. He designed and created all these amazing mental faculties that we have, and he tells us to make sure that we use them. The God of the Bible designed all that we can see and observe, whether we're looking through a telescope or a microscope or with the naked eye. We are all, as Paul put it in Romans chapter 1, verse 22, without excuse. without excuse. The only way that one might deny God is if they obstinately choose to deny God because they don't want to believe in Him. But if we exercise our God-given powers of observation and rational thought, we can verify the truth of God's existence, the truth of God's power, the truth of God's wisdom, the truth of God's glory, which was made manifest in this indescribably complex and beautiful world that we live in.